This is Jack Williams. Welcome to an EWTN Open Line week-long event, The Transgender Movement, What Catholics Need to Know, hosted by Mary Hassan. Today's episode is What Does the Church Say About Transgender Issues? With Dr. Teresa Farnan, founding member of the Person and Identity Project. After the program, we'll be back live with Father Mitch Paqua taking your calls and emails. But first, The Transgender Movement, What Catholics Need to Know, starts now.
I'm Mary Hassan, your guide to this series on the transgender movement, What Catholics Need to Know. Join us for this discussion with Dr. Teresa Farnan as we look at the theological and anthropological aspects of transgender ideology and questions of sexual identity. Join us for this important discussion.
Jesus answered, "He who made them from the beginning made them male and female."
Teresa, welcome.
I'm delighted to be here.
To my mind, you're the ideal person to talk about the theological and anthropological aspects of the person and transgender questions, sexual identity. You've been a seminary professor in several seminaries and taught at the Franciscan University. You're a master catechist. You're also a mom of 10. You're my sister, which I'm delighted to work with you. We were co-founders with Susan Selner Wright of the Person and Identity Project. So welcome. We're delighted to have you.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
So one of the questions that we often, or statements that we often hear, is that people will say the church has not really spoken clearly on questions related to gender identity, sexual identity, transgender issues, gender dysphoria, however you want to categorize that. Is that true? What do we need to know?
Yeah, that is not true. The church has really clear teaching on this issue. And it's interesting because the Catechism of the Catholic Church was first published in 1992. And in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, there's a section that talks about how each of us is called to accept his or her sexual identity. And the phrase, that particular phrase, sexual identity, is so important because it conveys that you as a person are an embodied human being, body and soul, but created either male or female. And so your biological sex is something that can't be just rejected or discarded, but it's integral to who you are. So even back in 1992, the Catholic Church was affirming the importance of that truth. And since then, in intervening years, beginning with Pope Benedict in his Christmas address to the Curia, where he talked about the dangers of gender ideology, and then continuing throughout the pontificate of Pope Francis, we've had very clear guidance from the Catholic Church.
So what did Pope Benedict say?
Pope Benedict warned about the dangers of gender ideology and how it undermines our understanding of who we are as a human being, right? And Pope, and that in rejecting your body, rejecting your creation as male or female, you are ultimately rejecting God the Creator. Right? So he described it as a sin against God the Creator to reject the gift of yourself, right? So in other words, you're claiming the right to create yourself in the image and likeness that you prefer rather than creating yourself as God intended.
And then Pope Francis.
And then Pope Francis has spoken specifically on this issue, first in his encyclical Laudato Si, where he described human ecology as kind of the first and most important step for an authentic environmentalism. In other words, you can't claim to be someone who is in favor of preserving and protecting the environment and cherishing all of creation if you're at the same time rejecting the gift of your own creation. And so he calls us to accept our own human ecology, that we're created either male or female, and that your body is an important part of this human ecology.
Doesn't he speak also to the idea that male and female form the anthropological basis of the family?
Yes, and he really amplifies that in Amoris Laetitia, which is, again, his apostolic letter on the family, where he talks about sexual difference as the foundation for the family. And so in accepting the propositions of gender ideology, you're rejecting that foundational truth and thereby undermining the family. And he uses very, very strong language in talking about it, undermining the family, annihilating the image of God in the human person, right? So he's not mincing his words. In addresses to the Polish bishops and to other conferences of bishops, he talks about gender ideology as something that undermines marriage, undermines the family, and in fact uses the term wicked when he talks about teachings that confuse and harm children's understanding of who they are. So there's very, very clear teaching from our Holy Fathers on this issue.
Yeah, so I think one important point just related to these teachings that you've unfolded is that the Church is speaking, when it speaks so strongly against this, it's speaking against the ideology. It's not making a judgment on the suffering of an individual, but rather talking about the harm that this ideology does.
Yes, exactly. And that's such an important point, because when we talk about any kind of ideology, there's always the ideas, and then an ideology always harms individuals, right? So we have the ideology, gender ideology, as an ideology that deconstructs people's understanding of who they are, and in that way leads some vulnerable people to reject the reality of their own sexed body. But then you have the individuals who are harmed by this. And that's the other side of this, that this is a very harmful ideology because it causes people to take steps that you not only internally reject the your sense of who you are, male or female, but it causes you to actually take steps to destroy to attempt to destroy the reality of your sexed body. And in that way, it's not just spiritually damaging, but physically harmful to these young people, and has ripple effects on the family and on the community as well.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point, that it affects relationships as well. Mm-hmm. So when you accept your identity, your given identity, I'm male, I'm female, and live that out, you're living that out in your relationships. When a person comes to the point, whether because they're confused, they're suffering in some other way, there's a background issue, but for whatever reason they have adopted this belief that they're really the opposite sex or neither sex or something else, when they do that, that changes their relationships with others, and that's damaging as well, right?
It is, and that's part of the understanding of human ecology too, though, is that it isn't just that we are created with this embodied as either male or female, or created with a male or female, you know, as a male or female person. The other aspect of human ecology is that you are created in relationships. You're born into a family. You have a mother, you have a father, you have a sister, you have a brother, you're someone's mother or father. And so part of the damaging effect of this ideology is it causes people to reject that. But in rejecting the reality of your sexed body, you're also upending all of those relationships. And so the ripple effect is just, it's so alarming, it's so concerning, and it has long-lasting effects on human relationships.
So let's talk about how this may play out, let's say, for the institutional church, when the church runs a school or mm-hmm. a hospital, and we'll talk about medical ethics in a moment. But what has the church, what guidance has the church given, for example, to schools or educators, parishes that are doing religious education? What kind of guidance have they given on this issue?
Well, we have guidance from the church in 2019 issued by the Congregation for Catholic Education that's directly on point in a guidance document entitled Male or Female, Male and Female, He Created Them. The Congregation for Catholic Education spelled out an approach for us. They said, we need to listen, and in listening, so the approach is listen, reason, and propose. Those are that's the foundation of any kind of authentic dialogue, and we know Pope Francis really calls on us to dialogue with members of our own church, with families, with our culture. So in listening, though, the Congregation for Catholic Education reminds us that science in so many ways is telling us we are created either male or female, right? So listen to what science is telling us. Every cell in the human body is created as either a male or female sex, or a male or female cell. There's no ambiguity, right?
And you can't change it.
And you can't change it. You can't change it. So listen to what science is telling us. Apply foundational principles of reason, such as that every human being has dignity and value, mm-hmm. that we're created in relationship, all of the fundamental principles that we know from Christian anthropology. But the most important point of that document, and the document that has meaning for our schools and our religious education programs, is the Congregation for Catholic Education reminded us that we need to propose Christian anthropology because we live in a culture that has forgotten what it means to be a human being, yeah. right? And so in reproposing Christian anthropology, we're reminding people that you're created as a human being. You're created either male or female, that your body is integral to who you are. You're created in a family, that parents are the primary educators of their children, and that these relationships are not fungible. They can't be destroyed at will. They can't be interchanged. These relationships are an important part of human ecology. And so in that document, the CCE called for dioceses and for bishops and schools to take really seriously their responsibility to ensure that every catechist and every teacher can answer questions and respond to concerns about gender mm-hmm. ideology mm-hmm. on the spot. So if you're in a school and you're a student throws off a comment about how men can become women and vice versa, the teacher needs to be able to say, well, we know that's not true because we know scientifically you're created male or female from the moment of conception, and we know, you know, that God creates you male or female. He gives you your body is a gift from Him, mm-hmm. and the relationships that He created, you know, that He embeds you in, so to speak, are a gift to you from the moment of your creation. And we need to be able to respond to that.
Right, and at the same time, a teacher in that situation might say something that reminds students, for example, to be compassionate. Some people are hurting, some people are confused, but here's the truth, and we need to be willing to speak that truth.
Exactly. And if a diocese or if a school forms their catechists and their teachers in, gives them a thorough grounding in what's going on with gender ideology, they will have that compassion because they will go into that conversation understanding that this is something that can be socially contagious. It deconstructs the child's understanding of who they are. It causes great medical and social harm. It causes harm to relationships. So with that in the back of their mind, I think it will be easier for teachers to be able to give a clear response with compassion, and that's what we're striving for.
Yeah, and that confidence in the church's teaching. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about medical ethics. So one of the key issues that arises when we're talking about transgender issues is this concept of gender transition, which really is an attempt to alter the body, to mm-hmm. alter its functions in a way so that the body will reflect the image or the desires of the person, because the person is feeling like they don't match up with their body. So what can you tell us about the church's teaching in terms of medical ethics regarding so-called gender transitions, these hormonal and surgical interventions to change the body to match those inner feelings?
Sure. Well, the most important thing to keep in mind is that when we're talking about children who are seeking a gender transition, these are children with healthy bodies. Right? Mm-hmm. So we're not talking about disorders of sexual development where the goal of a physician would be to heal and heal the body and restore functioning, mm-hmm. right? Okay. We're talking about children who already have healthy bodies. And so it's a foundational principle of medical ethics in general to do no harm. It's even more important in Catholic medical ethics that you, number one, you can't do anything that intentionally sterilizes a person. And we know the combination of puberty blockers followed by cross-sex hormones affect sterilizes.
And let me pause on that. I think that's something that people may not appreciate, because oftentimes you'll have a younger child who is expressing an identity that doesn't match their body, and they say, I want a boy, I want to be a girl, I am a girl. And so when that child approaches puberty, there's a lot of anxiety because their body is going to give them away as being really a boy. So oftentimes counselors and pediatricians will say, okay, we'll put you on puberty blockers. In other words, mm-hmm. we're going to stop that natural physical development. And part of stopping that natural development, mm-hmm. it means your reproductive organs don't develop, your genitals don't develop. So then when you add the cross-sex hormones, that's when you've got this situation where this child is going to be sterilized.
Yes, and the principle of totality in Catholic medical ethics dictates that you can't undertake an intervention like that that's so dramatic, so in other words, causing sterilization, without proportional benefit, right? Okay. And so then the question is, you're damaging a healthy body part. Would it be justified with chemotherapy, for example? You would be justified in this treatment because it's the only way to save a child's life. But we know that while children who go through a gender transition may have a short-term bump in their affective feelings because they feel empowered, the long-term studies show that the suicide rate is still high, that the rates of mental health illnesses are still high, that there are all kinds of catastrophic side effects, whether it's bone loss or, you know, loss of functioning of their sexual organs, whatever it is, there's some catastrophic health indications too. And so when you look at all of the evidence, it's crystal clear that these interventions cannot be justified. It's not justifiable, and we really should have some trepidation in thinking that it would ever be okay to damage someone's healthy body to affect a psychological wound, an internal wound, right? So in other words, that's what we're doing. We're changing the person's body, but we're trying to heal something that's internal, and that's never going to work, right? And there's no doubt that these are children who are suffering, but what we're seeing now with this growing population of detransitioners is that these children who are coming out on the other side of this gender transition are saying, like, hey, I had underlying mental health issues, and all of these interventions damaged my body. And so that supports the Catholic teaching that it's not permissible to mutilate a body or to harm a healthy body in order to address a psychosocial wound.
Right, and at the same time, a person who's suffering, let's take an adolescent who is feeling so uncomfortable with their body, or they're feeling depressed about their identity, and they're confused. They feel like they don't fit in. The church isn't saying, we have nothing for you, right? And psychology wouldn't say, we have nothing for you.
Right,
right. So what are some alternative ways that those situations can be addressed? If you're not going to go that medical pathway, then how do we relieve that suffering over the long term? Obviously, it's not an overnight kind of solution.
Yeah, I think the most important thing to keep in mind is that so many of these children who are coming into this have real suffering. They're really, really struggling. They're hurting, but they were hurting before they latched onto the idea of a gender transition, and they're going to be hurting at the end, even as they go through these treatments, because their underlying issues have not been addressed. So a child, we know how to treat a child who's struggling with depression. Right. We know how to treat a child who's struggling with anxiety, but the first step is to take the depression and the anxiety seriously, right? Yeah. And to say to them, hey, we know you're struggling. Let's see what's going on. How can we help to relieve this burden? How can we address some of the social factors that are causing you this anxiety, this depression? How can we help you? There's a huge percentage of children who have autism. Well, if you have a child who has autism, they are going to require skills to cope, because it can be challenging for a child with autism in order to mesh with his or her peers. So there are all kinds of things that we can cope with. And we know from the review that was just conducted on the Tavistock Clinic that
Tavistock, meaning in the UK.
In the UK.
This big gender clinic.
The gender clinic that was ordered to be shut down because it was deemed to be unsafe to children. And one of the things that Hilary Cass, the pediatrician conducting the review, warned about was what she called diagnostic overshadowing. So in other words, as soon as a child asserts that transgender identity, it takes over and nothing else is addressed.
So there's no exploration
of
any of the underlying psychological issues, trying to figure out what exactly is going on, looking at the child as a whole person with this complex background, experiences. None of that is typically, unfortunately, in gender-affirming care, none of that is unpacked.
Right.
There's instead this hyper-focus on moving swiftly towards gender transition.
Right. And just as if you had somebody who is struggling with mental health issues, you would want them to not engage in self-harm while they're going through their treatment. You try to keep them safe and help them through this. Similarly, with a child who's struggling with confusion about his or her sexual identity, we need to keep them safe. right? While we work on the underlying issues and get them
right,
through
and it. Be patient with that. Mm-hmm. So in just the last couple of minutes here before we close, remind us or unpack for us briefly, you know, why is this so important to get the theology right, the anthropology right? Why is this so important to the church, but also to the faith of individuals?
Yeah, the other thing that I think is underappreciated in this whole issue is the damaging effect this has on catechesis. And whenever I travel around and speak to different groups, I really try to highlight that if you're a catechist or you're a DRE, your child has been formed in an anthropology that's radically different.
By the culture.
So their understanding of the person is that the person has all these body parts that aren't necessarily related to who they are, and that there's no underlying unity of body and soul, and that your desires shape who you are. Your desires are the most important thing for your identity.
And what does that compromise in terms of faith?
Well, what that compromises is our understanding of the unity of the body and soul for the person, right? And our understanding of how we are created as an embodied person. That undermines foundational ideas such as the incarnation. How do we understand that Jesus Christ was incarnate, true God and true man, as a man, masculine,
right.
If we think that these body parts are fungible and have no meaning, right? How do we explain the church's teaching on marriage and family to our kids when they don't even think that you know, sexual difference even matters?
Right.
How do we understand, how do we explain morality? How do we explain divine fatherhood? There's so many areas of catechesis that are impacted by this. So every child in the parish is affected by this, whether or not they profess a desire to go through a gender transition.
So it's important to get it right. And thank you very much, Teresa, for helping us see the truth here.
Thank you.
What does the church teach us about what it means to be a human person? And in light of this, how should we view gender ideology? We'll discuss pastoral approaches and ways to support families and individuals experiencing identity confusion in the episode on pastoral care. But I sometimes hear people downplay gender ideology or claim that Catholic teaching does not address transgender issues. Some Catholics are confused about the nature of the person. Polls show that up to half of all Catholics, depending on age and ethnicity, believe that a person's identity is not determined by sex, but can change according to desire. So let's clarify a few things. Gender ideology is a global phenomenon rooted in age-old philosophies. The transgender movement, broadly speaking, envisions a utopian society based on its ideological beliefs. Activists portray cultural institutions that oppose these beliefs as oppressors and openly declare their goal to destroy or dismantle these institutions, particularly traditional family and biblical religions, such as the Catholic Church. It's important to recognize, however, that long before gender ideology became such a powerful force, the Church has had clear teachings about the nature of the human person and the moral life. And these teachings are rich and deep, and they offer sure guidance in the face of our modern confusion about the person and the ideological claims of the transgender movement. At heart, the cultural controversies over transgender ideology reflect a clash of anthropologies, competing claims about the nature of the person. So let's compare the core beliefs of gender ideology to the Christian understanding of the person. As Christians, we know we're created by a loving God, made in His image and likeness, and this is the source of our dignity. Created male or female, we're called to accept our sexual identity as a gift from God and to recognize our fundamental identity as a son or daughter of the Lord. We know, too, that we're a unity of body and soul, with a human nature that seeks the good. We're made for relationship and eternal life with God. It's clear that our bodies have meaning. And in the design of our bodies, we see that males and females are made for one another. And from this sexual union of male and female in marriage, new life comes into being. Our families, mother, father, and child, are meant to image the self-giving love of the Trinity. It's also true that we're inclined to sin, and all of us are broken and weak in some way. But God doesn't leave us in these difficulties. He sent His Son to die and redeem us. And thus, it's in Jesus Christ that we truly understand who we are. Now, gender ideology views the person very differently. claiming we are self-creating persons who define our own identities, which can change at will. Human dignity, according to gender ideology, is contingent. It becomes real only when affirmed by law or validated by the opinions of others. Gender ideology rejects the concept of human nature and views the person through a dualistic lens where the mind or will is what counts and the body is only a tool to be used or a canvas for personal expression. Because gender ideology denies the significance of the human body and rejects the connection between sexual intercourse and reproduction, it views sex as personal pleasure seeking with no boundaries on who, how, or how many, as long as there's legal consent. So marriage becomes simply an adult arrangement and families are chosen and often temporary. Finally, gender ideology has no understanding of sin, forgiveness, or redemption. Human relations are merely power struggles between oppressors and the oppressed, all on the long journey towards self-expression. The beliefs of gender ideology are incompatible with Christian anthropology. Activists use images like the genderbread person or the gender unicorn to explain this ideology to children, representing the person as an androgynous, incoherent bundle of dimensions, with each dimension expressed as a spectrum. The most important dimension of the person, according to gender ideology, is gender identity, a person's self-perception, their subjective feelings or beliefs about who they are. Gender ideology explains away the significance of the sexed body by describing sexual identity, male or female, as just a label arbitrarily assigned at birth. Children's books say it this way: when you were born, the doctor took a look at your body and made a guess as to who you are, but only you know for sure. So gender ideology teaches children that if they don't like their male or female label, they can peel it off, throw it away, and choose a new one. Bodily sex doesn't matter. The physical reality of our bodies then is just parts, body parts that can be replaced at will with new ones chosen to resemble the desired body or identity. Gender activists seek to impose these ideological beliefs on others, overriding parental rights, free speech, the rights of conscience, and even religious freedom. Worse, as our children's understanding of who they are is formed by gender ideology, it becomes harder for them to understand the beauty of God's plan for creation and to live His plan in their own lives. In a sense, this clash of anthropologies between Christianity and gender ideology is a rerun of that original sin in the garden. And like our forebears, we too face the temptation to believe that we can be like God, reinventing ourselves according to our own will. But God has a better plan if we only turn to Him and, as the Catechism of the Catholic Church urges us, we accept and acknowledge our sexual identity as male or female, welcoming it as the gift that God intends.
So that is today's episode of the Transgender Movement, What Catholics Need to Know. Another very enlightening discussion. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, Father Mitch is in the house, and we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, that number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email by participating that way. Just send us an email to openline@ewtn.com. That's openline, all one word, at ewtn.com. www.thetransgenderminute.com. And if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, we would love to interact with you in that way. Just simply type a question into the chat window and it will find its way to us here, hopefully before the end of the program. Father Mitch, another great episode to this really timely and poignant mini-series that the network has put together with the cooperation of Mary Rice Hassan. And I thought it was interesting that they really started this episode by addressing really kind of the overarching myth of this whole thing, and that is that the church really doesn't have clear teaching on the issue of transgenderism.
Right. And it's not only clear teaching. It's what's important in what they were saying is that the teaching is part of the worldview. It's not as if the church said, oh, we don't like this. No. It's integral to our teaching about what it means to be human and the incarnation of Christ, and how Christ is restoring humanity back to the image and likeness of God. This is our goal. So it's clear principles that are inherent in the faith and not tacked on. These modern problems are not issues that we approach in some dictatorial way, where it's a game of Simon Says, in our case, Simon Peter Says. But it's rather, you know, that we think these issues through to try to understand principle, but also to try to understand how we deal with individuals going through it as concrete persons. This is very, very important.
It is very important. In fact, Pope Benedict, as she mentioned, warned about the dangers of rejecting the gift of yourself from God.
Yes. That's what I mean by the integrity of the Catholic position with the whole of the faith. You are created by God. Now, of course, your mother and father contribute to your DNA, each one of them. And there is the physical reality. And yet, at that point, when the sperm enters into the ovum, the person is created, that there is a human soul created at that moment. And again, to enter into some of the arguments I've heard recently, even from the president, who should have had a better Catholic education. But he says that there's not a soul. No, we say that there's not a rational soul yet, that because at that point of conception, the embryo cannot hold rational thought. But that doesn't mean that there's not a soul. And so there's a soul that exists at that moment. It is unique to that person. And this is something that God has done, so that you are a gift from God. And this is very, very important.
We still want to hear from you. The number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. You can also chat with us on YouTube or Facebook Live. Or you can send us an email, openline@ewtn.com. Liz is in the great state of Michigan listening on Sirius XM Channel 130 today. Liz, you're on with Father Mitch.
Hey, Father Mitch. Thank you so much. Thank you, EWTN, for broadcasting this all week. Mm. So just real quick, my brother, I'm old. I'm 69. My brother, when he was a teenager, was not an athletic kind of guy. He was a music guy, and he loved music. He didn't like, and he was not a sports guy. And so while he was studying music, he actually had an experienced. I don't know this for a fact, but I think someone was maybe trying to groom him. He went to my mom, my Catholic devout mom, and said, "Mom, I don't know what's going on. I think I'm homosexual." And my mom said, "Stop everything. We're going to talk about this. We're going to take you to the doctor. We're going to work through this." And he worked through it. Mm-hmm. Because my mom knew him and knew that this was, his tendency was to be not like the male guys in his college. My point is, and I'm sorry I'm rambling, but I think I always have great respect for my mom, who's a devout Catholic and raised us both Catholic, mm-hmm. that she got him away from it. And yet eventually married and had children.
Right. And this is something that is very, very important to understand, is, and the purpose of talking about these issues is, at this point, the schools and sometimes teachers in the schools are trying to help students make decisions completely divorced from their parents. They're willing to help a child start transitioning, as they think, to another gender, which you can't really do, or to get people to work on their sexual identity without a conversation with their parents, sometimes not letting the parents even know. And parents, you know, are the ones who certainly ought to know their children better than anybody else. They've been with them from the start. Now, this also means, and this has been something that's been a concern of mine, parents need to discuss sexuality as a normal part of life in a respectful way at various stages when a child is ready for it. Unfortunately, some parts of our society want to introduce children in a sudden way to sexual issues out of context of that kid's specific growth. It's important for parents to have started discussing so that, for instance, in the case of your brother, he could go to his mom. He could talk to her, because I suspect they had, you know, a normal kind of conversation. I've been doing a certain amount of research. It's informal. It's not a scientific study, but I keep getting it confirmed by other sources that about 2% of boys learn about sexuality from their fathers. It's about 2%. Another 3%, their father might give them a book. I think girls learn a bit more, because the kind of changes that they go through require hygienic change and development that they have to learn about, and their mom should be the one to do that. Boys seem to not learn from their dads. And that's not some, I don't think it's something that when a kid is 12 or 13, all of a sudden, wham, you dump all this information on him about what's happening in his body. I don't think that's right. It should be, like my friends who raised on ranches and farms are very familiar with the animal's sexual behavior. And they learn about, what it means when the cows are in estrus and the bulls are chasing them. And they talk about these. And you explain those issues to a kid. But you don't explain more than they can handle. As a matter of fact, it's you answer every question they ask you. But when they start to get a blank look, you stop, because they can't absorb more. That's but that ends up making a conversation possible, whereas someone who is outside the family trying to introduce issues that may fit their own ideology, their own agenda, sometimes personal, but oftentimes cultural agenda. This is not, they almost act as if they are the shining knights coming in to rescue them from benighted parents. That is not right. And that's what I love about your story, is that your mom and your brother were able to talk about this as adults with conversations that had happened earlier on.
Still plenty of time for your phone calls for Father Mitch. The number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Your reactions to today's episode of the Transgender Movement, What Catholics Need to Know. John is in Stamford, Connecticut, listening on Veritas Radio. John, you are on with Father Mitch.
Hi, Father Mitch. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, John. What can we do for you?
Well, I guess my question is this. How did we get to this upside-down place we're in with all mm-hmm. of this? Because, sure. You know, I was saying to the young man who answered the phone, my son works for Dell up in the Boston area, and they're saying if you don't call the people by the proper pronouns and this, that, and the other thing, that you could be fired. And, you know, my son is a 4.0 guy, and I raised him Catholic. I'm 69 years old. I've been a Catholic all my life. And, you know, I read the Bible to them when they were young, and their little kiddie Bibles and all this stuff. And they grew up knowing what I, you know, my wife and I taught them about sexuality. Mm-hmm. Now with my daughter, she has three little kids. She's up in Massachusetts, and they're all girls, 1, 3, and 5. And she couldn't believe what was going on in the school system. Like, and she said to me, she said, "Dad, this is so far from our faith." I said, "You got that right." And she said, "What do I do?" And I go, "Well, you have a Catholic church there that you go to. There's a Catholic school, isn't there?" And she said, "Yes." I got to get them into that. I go, "Exactly." So they all got into the Catholic school except for the 1-year-old. And so she's happy about that because she found out. My daughter was trained in, she has a master's degree in psychology and stuff, Father Mitch, because she was dealing with highly autistic kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she researches everything, and she researched that it seems like the girls are the ones that first get approached with this stuff at school, like, what gender do you want to be? And I'm like, that's insanity. Oh, you know, God, you kind of know what gender you are if you're a male or a female, you know? And I said, that's just I call it the upside down world.
Yeah.
So I'm happy that they, you know, she got them into a Catholic school because I raised them in the Catholic school system for similar reasons. I was Mr. Mom for about 14 years, and I remember going to the public school here in town, and kids in like third grade were saying things about sex that I didn't know until I was probably in my teenage years, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And my son was gifted in science and in reading, and so I had to get him out of there. And I got him out of there, and I put him in a Catholic school system. I remember reading in the New York Times that for about 4 weeks they'd studied all these schools, and the Catholic school systems were the most successful in getting kids to go to college. Like 97% of the percentile were going to college and being successful and good people. Another thing that my son's dealing with is that he's in that technical part of Dell. He's dealing with all atheists. And I'm like, oh my gosh. I said, you know, John, God put you there for a reason. You have to be the light in that darkness. You have to help them.
Mm-hmm.
You try to lead them to the Lord, you know,
yeah.
And without, yeah. You know, in your own way. You don't have to be reciting Bible scripture or anything, but just be the kind person that you are, and they're going to see something's different in you.
Yeah, so what about all this, Father?
A couple things. When we see that you can get fired for the way you use pronouns, or in I think it's in New York, you can be fined a considerable amount of money if you knowingly and willingly use the wrong pronoun. And that is about control, social control. This is a societal-wide game of Simon Says. I mentioned that before. And you have to do what they say. And this is a kind of training in social control that what looks to be contrary to the information in front of your eyes, you have to go along with this. This is one level of problem. Secondly, it treats people not as if they are made in the image and likeness of God, by God, but it treats people as if they are silly putty who form themselves, that they fashion themselves any way they want. And the way that you are, there's a givenness.
It's one of their mantras is self-made.
Exactly, exactly. This is pretty close to the kind of temptation by the serpent in the Garden of Eden. That this idea that you can make yourself, when you didn't, you did not make yourself. Nobody said, oh, I want to be born now. That's not the way existence works. There is a givenness about existence. You are, and you know, some of us would like to be great athletes, and we're just not. I didn't have that kind of musculature to be, nor the coordination. And there's a certain given. I can work with what I've got, but there's a limit. And so that's the way life is. And accepting that givenness and working with the flaws and strengths is one issue. Another issue that concerns me, if you heard in the video and the program
today.
Yeah, today's episode, that what they give to these young people sterilizes them. Pay attention to that, because in certain segments of our country, the number one issue is the environment. And in certain sections of our society, the biggest threat to the environment is said to be human beings. The growth of population is a big threat. Now, in our country, back in the from the 30s to the 60s, lots of folks, especially African Americans, were sterilized, especially if they had mental disorders. This was sometimes criminal background. They were sterilized. And now, by the way, they didn't know that that was happening to them. They didn't get permission. They didn't know about it. With this ideology, you convince young people before they understand who they are to volunteer to become sterile. And they don't always understand what that means when they're asked to start, you know, we'll help you undergo this. When they, I don't know if they can do that anymore, didn't used to be able to even give an aspirin to a student in school without the parents' direct permission. And to have an aspirin is a fairly limited amount of time consequence, whereas this is a consequence for the rest of your life, and it is a very costly process because you cannot stop this process. You have to continue to take the hormone and other treatments for the rest of your life. This is, you know, kids don't understand what the rest of your life means. They can barely see their way to getting 16 and getting a driver's license. They can barely see their way to 21 where they can go out and buy a drink legally. That's about as much as they think ahead. And to think about your whole life long, you will be sterile and you'll be taking this expensive medicine program. And frankly, it is no wonder to me that one of the doctors who does this at Vanderbilt Hospital, shamefully, said this is a huge moneymaker. That may be part of the element. There's also, again, this population control issue. You know, another related to population control. I did a funeral recently, and one of the mourners and I got talking. Actually, he was the husband of a friend of the person that died, and he didn't really know the people. We were discussing things, and he was a researcher on the impact of water pollution on fish. He's a biologist, a professor of biology at a nearby university. And he was researching the impact of female birth control pills on fish. Others were doing it on amphibians. It's having a major impact. And he was wondering whether or not it isn't having an impact on the humans who drink the water, because hormones, female hormones, are throughout the water table. He didn't say it is. He raised a question based on his research with fish. Is this having an impact? And then are people making a decision because of the effect of water pollution from tons of birth control pills being dumped into the water table all over the world? It's a question we have to ask. And these are some of the issues we have to be concerned with. You know, is this part of an ideology to reduce population? Is this an effect of something like birth control pills polluting the water? What other controls are going on here? Those are my questions.
You know, and at the end of the day, these are all things that we have to struggle with in the natural, but, you know, we have an enemy, and he is a formidable enemy, and he has set his sights on the family for a long time.
Yep.
And as was mentioned in this episode, sexual difference is the foundation for the family.
Yep. This is, again, you cannot underestimate that. And we already are at a time when family is greatly compromised. 52% of all children in the country are born to unmarried parents. And that breakdown of family is very serious. And it's one of the concerns I have is that on one hand, elements of our society want to promote sexual promiscuity, but they want it without the consequences of children, number one, and number two, of sexually transmitted diseases. Whereas today, we have, you know, again, over 50% born out of wedlock, and about 20 to 25% of the population infected with diseases. And they're trying to mess around with us morally on lots of levels.
Father, would you leave us with a blessing?
Lord, bless you all and keep you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. Be sure to check out the Encore at 10 p.m. Eastern Time tonight. And we're back at it tomorrow with episode 4 of the Transgender Movement, What Catholics Need to Know. So be sure to join us afterwards with Father Brian Milady as we discuss that particular episode. Thanks so much for being with us during this EWTN Open Line week-long event. the transgender movement, what Catholics need to know. God bless.